Hello, and welcome to Life Lab. I'm David Ponder.
And I'm Zach Schaefer.
We created a candid podcast for busy people. We get right to the point of our topics, and we keep them to 30 minutes or less.
We wanted to put our ideas out there, share it with people we love, and if it spreads, great.
Our show has no edits and no gimmicks.
Like it or don't, we initially started this project for ourselves, to record our thoughts for our kids, but our friends and family thought we should share it, so here you go.
Hello, and welcome to Life Lab. I'm David Ponder.
Zach Schaefer.
And today we're talking about something that is ever-present in our lives that, like it or not, you're going to have to deal with, and that is change.
And not the kind you keep in your pocket.
That's right, that's right. So, everything, you know, as time goes on, everything is constantly changing, whether you like it or not. And so, it's something that I, as I've grown to be an adult, have had to learn to deal with. And it's something that I think if you deal with it well and you embrace it, you can have an advantage on other people. So with that being said, Zach, tell us your thoughts on the broader subject of change.
Well, I mean, you can go really macro or you can go micro with this. And I'm sure we'll talk about both levels of analysis throughout this discussion. But as someone who deals with change as part of one of my professions, you know, change management consultant, I find it really interesting the emotions that are tied to change. And you can see this at an individual level, but you can really see it at an organizational level. When a company is trying, change is just becoming different, period. That's it. Let's right. Do something different. And once that decree comes down that we're going to do something different, you can smell the fear. You can see the anxiety, the tension. So where I wanted to start was talking a little bit about people's reasons to not want to change.
That makes total sense. And may I ask or throw in an idea of internal change versus external change, sort of the Covey's circles of
control, yeah. Concern, and yeah.
And how does that play into that conversation that you're talking about? And the reason I say that is because when I'm introspective and I think about the times that I've had the most trouble dealing with change, often it was because it was something that I had no control over, or I really was trying to control an external environment
that's out of your control.
That was out of my control and flailing. You know, and feeling hopeless and helpless about it. So, you know.
Well, there's a lot we could go down there. Many people are willing and do change their behaviors, right, their outward expressions of their ideas, but internally they haven't changed, right? And this whole the intellectual freedom stuff we've been talking about, lots of people will go along one way or the other with that, but what they really believe about that idea hasn't been expressed, communicated, and they're not changing their mindset or attitudes.
So there's cognitive dissonance there, right? Their behaviors are in conflict with their beliefs. And so there's this deep internal struggle, a need to either change your behavior to meet your beliefs or change your beliefs to meet your behavior.
But it might not – I see what you're saying, and I agree at the surface level, but it might not be cognitive dissonance if they've reconciled the fact that Upton Sinclair's quote, "It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it." Right? So if you internalize that and you're like, I'm going to act this way but believe whatever I want, which is actually a law of power – there is probably no dissonance you're experiencing because you reconciled that.
That's great. Okay.
But lots of other people do experience that dissonance when they have to say and behave in certain ways that they don't internally, cognitively, or emotionally agree with.
Well, and maybe that what you're saying is you've mastered change in that second part. And the first part is your emotional response to change, potentially.
I don't know. When you say you, I'm not saying I've mastered change. We're talking in general here. Well, a couple things that I've noticed throughout paying attention to why and how people change in an organization or personally and why and how they don't. And really it comes down to a few things, and the most important one is fear.
Fear.
With change, everything revolves around that emotional response to fear. Fear of the future, fear of something new, something novel, a person, an idea, a new way of doing things.
The unknown.
The unknown, uncertainty, ambiguity. But from that, you can boil it down even further. at the core, humans want three things. We want security, we want love, and we want inclusion or connection. So if you're trying to get someone to change, first of all, we need to say you can't get anyone to change. People, that change is done on one's own, if that makes sense. Whether it's changing to improve and amplify a good habit or trying to change a bad habit, at the end of the day, you can just set the playing field for someone and they have to run the bases on their own.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think, you know, what you're hitting on is that people have to want to change. They have to agree. You can make a point to someone and say that the status quo is not right. Here are some problems with the way things are, right? But then they have to, A, agree with that, and then, B, get over that fear of the unknown to say it's worth exploring new things and risking the unknown because the status quo is so bad.
Right. No, absolutely. I have one small disagreement is sometimes people, they won't disagree that the status quo is wrong. But if their superior in an organizational setting tells them we're changing, there's not much latitude they have for saying, no, I'm not, other than I'm going to work somewhere else. So I think of it as a board, right? The executives or the leaders of a company working behind the curtain, so to speak, and we're all trying to sell our idea on how to best market this new product. Well, you win because you're really persuasive. My idea doesn't. Do I agree with you? No. I think you're wrong and your idea is dumb. But once we move forward from the door, we're unified and cohesive behind that. I still disagree with you, but a good leader then gets behind whatever decision is chosen for that change. So does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. What if you – so that's that problem with the – restraint of authority, basically, is what you're saying. The restraint is that I don't have the authority to do it. Someone is making me do it.
Yeah, I mean, in an organizational setting, yeah, whether we like it or not, all change comes from the top down, right, period.
So what would you say?
Most change.
That's right. What would you say when you remove that element and it's a person who may realize that the status quo is not right, but still can't make the change, like in an addiction or something like that?
Yeah, no, addiction is a difficult one because that then ties in physiological features in addition to cognitive features, mm-hmm, right? So that's beyond my scope, yeah, there. Okay, I would just say that addiction's a difficult beast to deal with, and that shapes behaviors and related to change in ways that are beyond my expertise.
So it's not a fear of the unknown. It's more of a somehow stuck to the status quo.
It's a fear of identity. It's a fear of loss, a fear of identity loss. Most people that are addicted have a certain perception of themselves in general and then a certain perception of themselves when they're under the influence of whatever it is, food, drugs, alcohol. And so then if people, for their own good, are trying to get them to change, it's a loss of identity. It's a loss of the life that they've lived out in their head.
And who they are.
Yes.
They
will it's all identity.
They are. It's brilliant. That's brilliant.
And so for me, the other things that come with fear of change are a loss of power or status, mm-hmm, even if it's perceived in one's head, which is actually really powerful. And then the last one is just loss of comfort, which is, again, tied to security. Mm-hmm. But I view comfort more about routines, about mindlessness, so that we're not having to make rational pro-con decisions for every single decision we have to make during a day.
So those were a loss of identity, a loss of comfort,
A loss of security, a loss of love, power, and a loss of connection to others. Yeah.
Okay.
So to me, those are at our core, at our philosophical and psychological core, that is why people don't want to change. Now, if I'm trying to help someone change, either in an organizational sense, in a relationship, because a lot of people come to me for these different things, it's not like I'm just going to pull out those things right away. But I'm going to ask a series of questions and continue asking why until one of these things emerges.
So do you try – as a leader, I always – and we've talked about this in the past – I try to gain consensus. If I am going to enact a change in my team, number one, they need to understand what the point of the change is and they have to agree with it on some level, at least enough to try it. Right. That's the way that I lead. When you are trying to facilitate change within an organization as a change management consultant, what is your step one?
Well, the first thing is what you would call requirements gathering, right? I can't come in and say, okay, here's all these models and systems we have for how change has occurred successfully in other organizations. Do this. Because it's all context-driven. Mm-hmm. Cultures are unique. People are unique. and every organization, of course, is like, my business is the most unique one in the world, as they should think that. So the first thing you got to do is come in and learn what's going on and why. You know, SWOT analysis would be part of that. Why are we having issues in the status quo? And what often happens is they'll point to the wrong thing. They'll point to symptoms rather than causes, because symptoms are easier to fix, but they're also fleeting and short term. I like what you said, though, about trying to gain consensus with change. I would say you can always bracket a change, because many people are uncomfortable with it. They want to know how we're going to change. Lay out the steps, the flow chart, the diagrams. People, change is rarely linear. Okay, it's messy, it's complicated. What you're trying to do is create order out of disorder. So first, just know it's going to get muddy. But if we have a plan, that's useful. Next, you need to explain why we're changing, the rationale behind it, right? So even those that are resistant to change, if you take the time to be transparent about your how and your why, they're more likely to get on board. Lastly, and this is the most important tool organizationally people can use, is put your change in brackets. Just say it's going to be an experiment, and give it enough time for people to do it, 90 days, 6 months, depending on what change you're going for, and then say if it doesn't work, we can revert back. It's not like it's this, we have one choice and we're going ahead to stay the course or not.
That makes total sense. So you're creating a system for them so that they see the path. You're giving them some sort of comfort by easing their fear of the unknown, by saying, oh, if everything goes wrong, if the unknown turns out to be bad, we can always go back, guys.
What I've found is that, and this is really interesting because you're very logical. You work within a field that's completely, for the most part, data-driven, but we're still human. We still have, we act like we're not, but we want to bury all those emotions, right? Change typically occurs from stories. Rarely is it you hand someone a spreadsheet with a flow chart. Here's how it's going to go. Great, that's a good visual. You need to add the stories of other organizations and how successfully it's occurred to plant those emotions, to excite people, to give them hope that the future will be useful. And Ron Howard, the famous actor, producer, director, he says that good storytelling is two parts emotion, one part logic. It just needs to make sense and ring somewhat valid or true. But at the end of the day, storytelling, which is how humans can get other humans to begin to change or to set them up for success to change, it's all about emotions.
It's so funny you say that. Because in so many of the hot button issues today, we like to say that we can rise above our emotions. You know what I mean?
Why do I not watch the news?
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Because it's emotional reaction. That's why I don't watch it. They're trying to get you to emotionally react, often in a negative way. Right. And for me, I view it as a sense of control. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to control not necessarily what I think, but at least what I think about. And we could go down agenda-setting theory.
Sure.
But again, even the media. Let's talk about the media and change. What is the media trying to influence people to do in terms of change?
I think it's a consumer-driven thing. So they're trying to convince you that your status quo isn't good enough and that you need to purchase a service or a good in order to improve your status quo.
Yep. So we've got bunny ears on our TV so that we can watch NFL games on Sundays. And for some reason, I was flipping through the channels last year and saw that Columbo, the old detective show, comes on Sunday evenings. And it's a goofy show, and I had never watched it. We started watching it, and my 4-year-old daughter on Sunday nights is like, can we watch Columbo? And in between that, I always put it on mute in between for the commercials, because as I tell my daughter and my kids, they're just trying to sell us junk and crap. And it was fascinating to see how the news, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 2, how they advertise themselves and try to sell themselves to us. They're hawking fear. Yeah.
The weather is coming.
Yeah.
Bury your head in your knees, but stay tuned to us. We'll keep you and your family alive.
We're the only ones who can keep you informed.
Oh my God. It went from like weather.
Download our Skywarn
to tracker. Shootings to traffic.
Yeah.
And the way that the music is used and the colors and then all of the scrolling text. It's creating an environment.
It's an environment of fear.
It's great, man. It's so brilliant.
Like, I love how they'll introduce a story. They'll be like, oh, this new toy is coming out that could potentially be disastrous. Stay tuned and we'll tell you how to protect your children.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like,
it's great.
If you don't watch our news and you know,
you're going to die.
Your children will probably die because of a new toy that's coming out. So, you know, talking about what we were saying, people are afraid of change because they, no matter how bad the status quo is, it's the fear, it's the bad that you know. Being less than the bad that you don't know, the potential bad that you don't know.
Right.
But it's like the media has figured that out. And so their goal is to convince you that your status quo is worse than anything that could be in the future if you just enact the information and steps that they're going to tell you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? So that's actually kind of a brilliant strategy. If you're trying to get somebody to change, just try to convince them that the status quo is so bad that – The unknown is going to be better almost by default. And they need to take the next step.
That's how the entire industry of politics works.
Sure.
Everything is fear-driven messages, but so is pharmacology. Watch any pharmacology commercial. You know, if it's not giving old men boners, it's, oh, it's life is, I'm so sore and this one drug is going to save me. You know, it's playing on those fears.
So I think we've hit the motivations for and against change. And the idea that fear and emotion play a huge role into it. I have a question, which is, when you're trying to enact change, and I'll tie this back to something we often reference, our kids, and trying to get them to learn something or change a behavior. The way that I see it as a parent is there's two ways I can do that, with positive or negative reinforcement. I can give them a reward for changing the behavior, or I can punish them for not changing the behavior.
Or both. It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive.
Yeah. Do those things play into your consulting and organizational change?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And what is the nuance between the two? Because as a parent, I'll be honest, I don't know when to do which or when not to, and which is it more advantageous or not. It's probably something I should.
Dave, you mean you're not turning to the experts to create a strategic, rational plan for how to best motivate your children? I say that with jest, but it's true. If the most people say family is the most important thing. Okay. Well, we spend all this time trying to understand what experts think to create systems and structures in our organizations. Right, to make those better. And yet when we get home, people just completely either wing it or they're so dependent on Google that they're stressing themselves out and creating anxiety.
That's exactly
There's very little middle ground, in my opinion.
Oh, no. We, our six-month-old Dylan is having a hard time going to sleep at night. So I was Googling Marin too, at bedtime. So Marin, our three-year-old, at bedtime. I Googled, you know, my toddler's not tired at bed. Mm-hmm. I got two results from seemingly reputable sources that were exactly in opposition for each other. I just laughed.
But to me, that is the human factor, even in science, right? Science is the systematic creation of truth and knowledge to where it's tested, right? If you're a scientist, you're someone that says, I'm willing to put out my evidence and conclusions to a community of intelligent people, and I am prepared to have that information falsified. That's the difference between a scientist and a non-scientist, right? So, but there's a human factor. We also have status that we're trying to achieve. So when you ask a research question, whether it's related to change or anything, by nature, you're focusing in on that. It's a fateful question. You're going to do research to try to understand and answer that, and you're going to ignore lots of other things because you just don't have time to include everything. It's narrowing the scope, so to speak, right?
Sure.
I don't know. We're going down a research hole. Okay, you had a question. I wanted to make sure we got to it.
Yeah, so I was asking about positive and negative reinforcement.
To me, you have to use both, right? And if you're talking organizationally or even familially, it's tied to the culture of that collective. So Gary's industry, completely
financially
driven, right? Yep. Hit this, we'll give you money. hit this, we'll send you on a cool trip. Other industries might be more punitive, but then it's usually tied to safety, right? So if we have an accident up, then we stop contributing to this fund and, you know, giving out the safe environment award.
Right.
So to me, it's tied to that environment. You probably need to do a bit of both. But if I'm coaching and working with someone at the individual level, I'm figuring out what best motivates them. Are they more motivated by disincentive and fear, or are they more motivated by positive and repetition of positive ideas?
So what are those steps to figure out what motivates either someone else or even yourself?
Well, communication. You have to have a conversation with people and ask a lot of questions to understand what truly drives them, what values them. I mean, if you can get them to take – again, if you're in a consulting relationship, then you can use tools, personality assessments, right? Mm. So I can learn a lot. I already know a lot about you and how to motivate you outside of our own friendship simply because I know what your personality is based on behavioral data. So if you have that, you can use that to motivate people, to set them up for success, for change. But they still have to walk down it on their own. I read a book, an excellent book on change. It's called Changing Bad Habits. And it's really tied to addiction, about trying to overcome any bad habit. But they focus in on nicotine, drinking, and overeating. And they make a lot of really interesting points. They say that people go through stages before they're willing to change. And so they have all these different six stages: pre-contemplation, contemplation, planning or preparation, action, where you're actually taking the change, making change, maintenance, and then termination. And I've been trying to think of ways to pull in these stages in an organizational setting to say, you guys are talking about change, but you're not near the planning stage. You're in pre-contemplation. You keep looping back away from the fact that you need to change. You don't have the desire there to do so. It's a really good book, especially if people are struggling with bad habits. It's overcoming bad habits, and it's all based on behavioral science. Very good. It's a boring, very dry academic read, so if that's not your thing, don't read it.
But change is an important thing to master, so... maybe, you know.
It is. But I think where these guys got it wrong, and they're three PhDs, they're all social psychologists and practicing clinical psychologists, is they wrote the book for other psychologists, in my opinion. They need a marketer to come in and take those ideas and make them visual and beautiful and easy to comprehend and more useful. But this book was so powerful, Dave.
You're hitting on a couple things.
American Cancer Society, I don't know the names of these organizations. The number one organization that's committed to helping people quit smoking, quit drinking, overeating, they have adopted this behavioral change model in all of these fields. And these guys didn't set out to create a whole new model to change the way behaviors and change are thought about. But this model was so powerful. Cessation smoking. It used to just be, let's punish you. And they're like, you're wrong. These people, you're hitting them as if they're in the planning or action stages. They're in the contemplation. They're just thinking about whether I should change.
Mm. It's interesting. So what you were saying about the book is their system is very powerful, but they do a poor job of telling the story. Poor enough that another organization who is reliant on their system is doing a better job of telling their story than them. So, yeah.
They told it well for their audience.
Right.
But okay. I read it.
Not as that audience.
Not as that audience. Yeah. And I even have a PhD, and it was still really dense.
Yeah, that's saying something.
Well, let me ask you this. How important is changing environments, changing a setting, just on a normal day, a work day?
I think it's important on multiple levels. And, you know, I always talk about you are, in your subject matter, very structured and – It's like applied science knowledge that you bring to the table, where a lot of times I bring these highfalutin ideas and things. So I think the change of environment kind of straddles that line, because it leads me to something that I've heard often, which is that our brains become developed to what we experience over and over again being the path of least resistance. It's like we get these super highways that dig themselves into our neurons, and so you can travel faster on those. So these are the default paths that that your thoughts follow.
It's like water.
Yeah.
It carves away that rock, yeah. And then it stays in that path.
And it goes to the lowest point. I think changing your environment is a good method of attempting to take, you know, reroute those or take an alternate route. I think there's something healthy about change when it comes to your mind and your psychology. Seeing and understanding different viewpoints, experiencing different emotions, and surrounding yourself with a different environment, I think, is an important step in doing so. There was a really great podcast that I listened to called Where There's Smoke that had a happiness episode. And it said novelty is a huge component when they do studies on happiness. And they suggested doing simple things like taking new routes to work, mm-hmm. going to a different coffee shop every morning, things like that.
Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, one of my tactics, and there's a lot of science behind this, which I'm less interested in, I am constantly changing my environment in a normal work day, either by conscious choice on my part or because I'm just having to hop around to different venues. And every time I call it the energy explosion, it just gives me a new sense of energy, that new perspective. There's different things going on, different smells, different sounds. It reactivates my brain in new ways, and I love that.
I
feel sorry for people who don't get any environment change throughout their day.
That's true.
Especially if it's out of their control, which it's not. You can always change jobs.
Three quick thoughts on that. Number one, this goes back to the spontaneity episode.
It does.
Where we talked about how you have interwoven spontaneity into your life and you're so good at it. And that's a skill that I would encourage everyone listening to internalize and try to activate. Number two, we can apply what you said to both the situations of internal change and an addiction. You know, you always hear about people who are an alcoholic or whatever. It's the group that they hang out with that supports it. It's the places that they go that they're constantly confronted with their old, and then the behavior comes back. And so things correlate with each other and cause other, you know, repeating behaviors. So in order to change maybe one behavior, I'm sure there are studies that support that it helps you succeed to change something that you associate with that behavior, like your environment.
Absolutely. I mean, that book, Changing for Good, that's what it's called, Changing for Good. It has a ton of what the difference between strategies and tactics. They cover both, but they call them processes and something else. But they give you all sorts of ways to control your external stimuli, right, in that environment. Get rid of all the booze in your house. Stop going to the bar. There's a term, psychological term called countering. So if you're drinking at night from 8 to 10 p.m., what are you going to do to counter that? You can't just sit at home. You're going to exercise. You're going to start reading. You're going to go for walks with your wife. So they walk through all sorts of very concrete losing weight. If your goal is to lose weight, a lot of people will stop and be like, well, I just didn't get a chance to ride the bike today. Okay, well, that's just one way you can do to achieve the goal or strategy of losing weight. And so they do a great job of saying, formulate your strategy or the how, that goal, and then figure out all the different ways to achieve change. Here was something interesting. Is quitting drinking a behavior?
Yes.
It's an outcome. Quitting drinking is an outcome of all the other behavioral changes you need to make, like you were talking about. Change your environment, change your friends, internal goals, how you think about yourself, your identity.
So that system you were talking about that the book was written about would be the system is you change these things. This is the outcome that you're going
It's a great book. Again, it's full of these very short assessments you can take to figure out what phase you're in. Because if the goal of change is to become different and make it stick, you've got to figure out what phase you're in order for that change, especially if it's related to a bad habit. You got to figure out that stage. Because if you're in the wrong stage and you're applying the wrong tactics, the change will not stick.
So I love this idea that changing things that surround what you want lead to that outcome, right?
Help
lead to that outcome. So many people skip and they just go right to that. How can you apply what we talked about in an organizational change setting? So like if I'm a leader and there's something that I want to change about my team, I have to view that as not changing. We have to directly change that. I have to look at all the things that lead up to it, all the behaviors.
The antecedents.
And the inputs, the environmental inputs, and say, which of these can we change that will influence this to happen?
Again, it goes back to discovery, requirements gathering, data collection, research, whatever you want to call it. You can't just have one person in an organization say, here's what we want to do, or even bring in the Boston Group, McKinsey Group, my consulting company, spark discussion. You've got to then learn what's going on both in that micro environment, in their specific industry, and then maybe even at the macroeconomic level to truly understand why someone or an organization needs to change. And then you think about, okay, now how?
So let's give some concrete examples. We talked about changing your environment as an individual that's advantageous for happiness just by experiencing novelty. I thought, you know, and that would be a great time as an organization. If an organization were changing environments, they were moving offices or they were moving floors in a building, that would be an advantageous time to work in a new behavioral change that you wanted to enact in your employees as well, because, you know, they're in this state of flux and they're removing those old that old environmental association. So there's probably a little bit better chance of success during that time. Now, you can't just change environments for your entire organization.
Right.
So what are some other concrete things that you could do?
Let me make a quick comment. Again, it goes back to context. I see what you're saying, and I agree 75%.
Okay.
If you already have a change going on, add in another change because it just makes sense. Well, bankers, very traditional group, resistant to change for the most part, not just bankers, banking industry. Right, their change is going to occur much more incrementally. So if you pile on too many changes at once, it'll make that culture, that organization feel uncomfortable. Other changes, healthcare, it's nonstop change, right? Their status quo is just dynamism, responding to regulatory changes, new diseases emerging, etc. They're much more comfortable dealing with multiple changes at a time. Panera, I was actually trying to prospect Panera as a potential client. In that retail environment, when they're selling, I mean, those people are on their feet. They are responding to a lot of stimuli at once. So their status quo is being pulled 10 directions in the same time, if that makes sense.
No, that makes total sense.
Yeah, so I'd pay attention more to the culture and the industry that an organization's in to determine how quickly we should change, right? Because any change, every organization wants to hire someone and say, okay, let's get this change project done. And it's like, well, it's not an event. It's a process.
Yep.
It unfolds over time and often many months or years.
Okay, that totally makes sense. So I think that my question was, if you have a associated thing that was already changing, mm-hmm. can you take advantage of that?
You
said yes, but you can't always rely on that. So then, assuming that you don't have an associated thing that is changing that you can also tie this to, you said when we're talking about drinking and changing that, or we're talking about applying this to the organizational structure, it's a result. The change that you're trying to achieve is a result of changing certain things or behaviors, smaller things in, you know, a stepped fashion. Like you said, baby steps or incremental change leads to this thing. So after you get through the information gathering phase for change in an organization, what are some examples of the concrete baby step changes?
Here's where you go. Let's imagine I'm working with a manager or a leader. I collect the data from all, I basically do a 360 degree review, get feedback from everyone that is a direct report of this person. And it's very clear that they are a poor leader. They do not clarify expectations. They are bad with feedback loops and following up. They are completely passive aggressive, so people don't know how to communicate with them directly. They have to walk on eggshells when they're around them. So what you shouldn't do if you're trying to set someone up for success to change is come in and say, here's the 25 things you need to do differently. It's to hone in on, here is the first thing, going back to Marshall Goldsmith, here is the key, the lever, if you will, the key behavior that you need to change. And where does that come from? From that data collection. You have people prioritize what changes they would like to see. Now, from a business standpoint, the consultant needs to do a good job at tying the individual behavioral change to organizational goals and strategy and ROI as well. That's a separate conversation. But once you do that, so let's say, people never know if you're happy. So I'd come in and say, look, you're not going to go from this data that we got, which sucks, to look at that mirror and see all that negative data. But if the goal is to improve and become better, or change, here's what we need to do. When you meet one-on-one with people, you're going to start it off by asking a question about their personal life and build some rapport. You're going to smile. That's it. Do that for a month. Get feedback from people. Advertise the fact that you're doing these things, right? Then I'll go back and collect data and say, how is that going? Great. Then we add the second thing to start doing, right? You build. It's like John Wooden, right? He won 11 championships in a row by teaching his players how to put on their socks appropriately so they didn't get calluses and blisters on the bottom of their feet. It's going back to the fundamentals. And with things like conflict or communication, which are always part of change in any setting, you've got to just remind people, slow down.
You know what's so cool? What you're saying, we've been taking these dual tracks. If you want to affect change for yourself and your personal life versus if you're trying to affect change at an organization, we've been going down these. But when we get to the brass tacks of what you're saying here, it's the same.
It's whether security, love, yeah. Inclusion, connectedness, power, status.
Whether you're trying to get a company, like you said, you have to if you want to incentivize it in the organizational setting, you tie it to the business objectives, their return on investment, their money, whatever. On the individual side, I'm sure it's like, well, if you want a young man to believe or to get to where women like him, right? He's having problems getting women.
A relationship.
You know, you have to tie these incentives to the change. But in both of those situations, your first step is applicable. Be interested in the other person. Ask a question about them and smile.
Listen. Understand. Seek to understand, not to explain. Absolutely. Here's something I wanted to say. Success and change are positively correlated to movement and action. Success and change. Now, this was a quote, and I added some things to it, and it comes from a John Maxwell book. I think the original quote was like, success is related to movement. Successful people, they keep moving. They keep going ahead. They keep painting the fence. But I think change is the same way, and it's related to action, right? If you want to lose weight, don't go look for the best coach and the perfect program. Get off your butt and start walking, then start jogging, then start running.
So successful people are doers. And it's interesting, again, I'll tie this back to that same podcast episode I mentioned about happiness. Because in addition to novelty, another thing that they mentioned that impacts happiness positively is progress. So if you're building a fence and the fence was 10 feet long when you woke up and it's 15 feet long when you go to bed, you can feel good about that because there's progress.
Right. I mean, think of the term change management. That's an entire field. It's applying science to the art of change.
And psychology.
No, like people can become certified change management professionals.
Okay.
Now, right? Okay. So most consulting firms are change management firms. They're working with companies to help manage that mm-hmm. change process. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they're using science to try to create order out of seeming chaos.
Right.
At the highest level, that's what's going on. And it makes people feel good to have a plan, to have John Cotter's 8 steps of change management in front of them. In reality, and Cotter talked about this, it's nonlinear, right? Are you familiar with the term entropy?
Absolutely.
Yeah, the tendency, for those of you that aren't, the tendency for a system to constantly move towards deterioration and chaos.
It's a law of the universe.
Absolutely.
Everything is constantly
comes out of, I think, thermodynamics.
Entropy.
Anyway, think about that at your house. If you got kids, the room is constant entropy. How are the toys just constantly accumulating?
Where does this dust come from?
I must spend an hour a day picking up toys now.
Yeah, at least.
Anyway, here's some areas where I think we overlook change that is just constant. And maybe we do so for instinctual psychological reasons that's tied to our ephemeral nature on this planet. Like the fact that we're going to die.
And our need for order?
And our need for purpose in the universe. Mm-hmm. Our physical bodies are literally dying every day.
It's true.
We are aging out of existence.
I love to say when people say, you know, point out something, this is bad. You know what that's bad for you? And I'm like, yeah, you know what else is bad for you? Time.
Mm-hmm. Time is the worst thing. Our minds, our thoughts, our cognitions, most people, they're changing. They're evolving. Many people, not all, many. Technology, easy one. Science is the incremental progression towards truth, knowledge, and understanding. I love that.
Right? And so that's why when people are like, well, they told us to eat eggs, now they're telling us to not eat eggs. It's because they can only study so much at once. And all of these different studies, imagine a big pile of knowledge. As it tends to accumulate more and more and more, then you'll see these patterns throughout this big pile of knowledge. That's what science is.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time, and it's not sexy.
And it's like methodical. You're surrounded – that pile of knowledge is surrounded by all these other piles of knowledge. And only when you can see over the neighboring pile of knowledge will the picture become a little bit more clear.
Yeah, yep, yeah. Absolutely. And then internally, our desires, our preferences, our goals, those things change all the time, mm-hmm. especially tied to – major life milestone events, losing a job, getting a job, getting divorced, getting married, having kids, someone dying, etc. And if not, I mean, I'd challenge someone to say, you think the same way you did when you were 18, then when you were 25, then when I'm 34 or 35.
And tying back to the intellectual freedom episode, which is why I've always found it so important to be able to consider and discuss with the people that I love all ideas, you know, no matter how controversial, because I have changed the way that I think about the world almost 100% since I was 18. It's crazy. But yeah.
I've got a new phrase that I like to use when my ideas change, and I just say my thoughts evolved.
Yeah.
New evidence, new data emerged. Something happened in my life. I had an experience that I can't explain through evidence or logic, but maybe it's an emotional experience, or maybe some people have religious or some people, of course they do, religious or spiritual experiences. But at the end of the day, everything we're discussing right now still goes back to the fact that humans are emotion chasers. We are the greyhounds chasing the little rabbit, and the rabbit is either maximize my positive emotions or minimize my fears and anxieties. That's it. Everything we do in life.
Yeah, there was a very powerful quote. I don't know who said it, but basically that what they said was, it doesn't matter. Nothing else matters in your life. Your life can boil. All it boils down to is how you feel on a daily basis. If you go back, that's the only metric that matters. If you have felt happy and positive on a daily basis for the majority of your life, that's the goal.
Right.
Everything else is just
noise. An accumulation of our emotions.
It doesn't matter how quote unquote successful you are, or rich you are, or surrounded by
or
power,
smart you are,
it doesn't matter if you feel bad. It's amazing.
And typically,
when you boil
those
that
feel bad are pretty good at making others feel bad who are close to them.
Well, whenever I see someone being outwardly aggressive, I try to remind myself that they are just trying to enact how they feel. They must feel pretty bad on the inside to try and force that onto other people. It's crazy. Okay, so. Man, you hit some really powerful things there. We're always changing in our life. We're always going into new phases of our life. You know, tying it to what's familiar to me is having kids and seeing how much they change in the beginning. Oh. It's at a very rapid pace. Seemingly, you know, one week to the next, like there are these entire different things that you're having to deal with. And that never really stops throughout life. As an adult, it seems to slow, but people are constantly going through changes in, you know, phases of their life, relationships, life and death is a natural part of things that you have to go through.
Death is part of life.
Death is part. It is. It absolutely is. So with all that being said, and death is something that we fear and we don't want to talk about that fear. With all that being said, do you have a quick high level overview of how people can enact, you know, a system to deal with and maybe even embrace change to try and, what we talked about, maximize positive feelings throughout the process, because change is life, and minimize negative feelings? I mean, it's a really hard
thing.
Yeah,
I mean, you're
asking
me
I'm
asking
you for the answer.
You're asking me for a universal formula to personal change to happiness.
Well, I'm asking you, how do I live my life?
If I had that answer, we wouldn't be fucking sitting right here, I'll tell you that.
Right.
No, but I mean, I have some answers, but there is no universal formula, even though I'd like to act like there is and go sell that. It just doesn't exist. So think inside out. If you're looking to change in any aspect of your life, you've got to do an emotion inventory.
what makes you feel good and why? What makes you feel bad and why? How much time do you devote amplifying or minimizing those feelings? What activities are you doing when you're amplifying or minimizing those feelings? My change challenge, which I don't want to be completely done yet today, but I'll throw one out there, is look for momentum opportunities. If you want to change, look for an area, whether it's lose weight, gain weight, start reading more, make more money, enhance my career status, spend more time with loved ones, connect with old friends that I haven't talked to in a long time. Find the momentum opportunity. I'll give you an easy one.
So information gathering. Step one is information gathering.
Yes, internal information gathering about your feelings and your emotions.
So where do I have an area of weakness, of negative feeling, of a lack of feeling, mm-hmm. a hole?
It goes back to, Tim Ferriss's fear setting.
Yeah.
Thinking through the fears, and that was on a previous episode.
Yes, that's good.
But then next, look for those small opportunities to get momentum, to push the ball down the road. Great example. I had in the last 2 weeks, I've had a recurring thought, I need to call Roderick, who is my former little brother in the Big Brother Big Sister program. We're still friends, but he sort of aged out of the program, and I have a new little. And finally, yesterday, the thought popped up again. I picked up my phone and instantly texted him, and then we called each other. That was a momentum opportunity. Mm. Did it make me feel good? Yes, because I have a need to maintain connections, and we had a great conversation. Right, so find those small opportunities and begin to change.
And then, that was an example of doers
actions.
Are more successful.
Yeah, I mean, we could get philosophical for the moment, but I know what you're saying. At least in terms of changing,
at least
yes.
it's correlated. Yeah.
So that's what I think. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I love the idea of identifying momentum opportunities, things that you can do now or very soon. That will get you a little bit closer to whatever it is that you're striving for. So I like the first step, and I think that that's a critical step as well. Be introspective. Identify area. Do the fear setting exercise. Identify areas where you feel like you need something, where you need change.
Right.
And then make an easy, simple change as a first step towards one of those areas to get momentum.
Yeah. The simplicity is key with this. Here's something, though, that I wanted to throw out. What do you think of the phrase, the more things change, the more they stay the same?
I think that there's definitely some truth to that. And it goes back to, for me, what you were saying about, you know, everything boils down to we need security, we need love. And we need, what was the other one?
Connection or inclusion.
Connection and inclusion.
And those are the positive things we want to amplify. The negative ones that we want to prevent are loss of power and status or loss of comfort and routine, which, again, they're tied to some of the other ones.
So I believe everything, even human emotion, changes over time through generations, through the process of evolution. But I believe that some of those things, like those three elements that we're talking about now, change very slowly, or maybe they will never change at all, just given the pace of which they change. So, well, there are other faster changing things around them, environmental things, external things that can be radically different today than they were yesterday. You know, like if you travel back in time, the entire environment, every system, every structure would be almost unrecognizable compared to how it is today. However, those three elements would still exist because the one constant there is us, as humans, people.
Absolutely. The way that I break it down is it's a systemic conversation for me. So at the micro systemic individual level, of course, things are always changing, right? As we get older, an easy one. When you're 80, you're probably not lifting as much weight as you did when you were 25. Okay, but at the systemic level, at the infrastructure level, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We went from mail to email. We went from TV being ultra popular to YouTube and digital streaming. We went from radio to podcast. So to me, the supra systems operating in the background, our current form of government, democracy, the social structures we've created, capitalism. That's when I think people are saying that what they're talking about is our systems. Mm. The more we change and tweak things, the systems guiding all those small tweaks are still the same.
Mm. Okay, that makes total sense to me. I think about the conversation that we had about the superorganism that is the human race, and the fact that it appears that everything that we're doing technologically, at least to this point, is to increase our connection to each other and to the universe. And it's interesting that that's one of the pillars that we talked about is connection.
I want to hit on one thing, and then we should probably wrap up because we're approaching 50 minutes. You said that you felt that human emotion, the emotional continuum that humans can experience, did you say it's changed over time or it will change?
It probably does change, okay. But I think it's probably tied to evolution, which is a very slowly changing thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, research has shown that humans, for the most part, have experienced the same, you know, six emotional factors in every culture from all time. They are surprise, joy, sadness, anger, disgust, and I believe the last one's fear.
Wow.
And so they would say they don't change.
Maybe they don't.
But if we begin to get infused with machine learning or artificial intelligence and human consciousness, I would assume that our emotions are going to change.
Maybe.
I
don't know. That's a great question.
I've always thought it crazy that what we've done with computers is created them to help us think more quickly and process information more quickly. Then we said, wow, that's really useful. Humans need to be more like computers. We need to think more objectively and do things more efficiently and rationally. And now it's going the other way. Now we need to make computers more like humans and more subjective and emotional and be able to read all of our cues and facial expressions.
Well, it's funny. We always personify everything.
Right.
We judge – we base our – this is an aside. We base our judgment of animals based on their personified characteristics.
Whether they have a face or not. There's a term for that. Yeah. I can't think of it. Anything else you want to hit on? Do you have any change challenges you want to throw out to our listeners?
This one was so – we had such diversity of thought on this one. I don't.
Fine.
I think yours is great, which is – if I remember correctly, do some introspection, identify an area of weakness, and take a momentum, enact a quick momentum.
But even in your language, changer. I disagree.
Okay.
Not an area of weakness, an opportunity to do something different, to take the path that you haven't taken
there's
before.
There's the neuro-linguistic
right, but by part. Saying
weakness,
I'm weak,
yeah.
it's all, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that. Identify an opportunity.
Momentum opportunity.
And enact it and do something about
it. Absolutely. Well, thanks for listening today. And like we always say, experiment with life.